It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
I just realized I said life and taxes. That's the other show.
That's right.
But that's Andrew's show. We got Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us here for Let's Talk Legal. Hi, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning. What are we talking about today?
Bill, we're having a little bit of tongue-tying this morning, aren't we? Where did Bill come
coffee.
From? I don't know.
Right.
Listen, Ben... Mm-hmm. Good morning. We are going to talk about will contest, mm-hmm. some of the grounds, some of the law relative to what makes a will valid and when sometimes one can come forth and file what is known as a will caveat, a challenge to the will under the laws of the state of North Carolina. So we're going to talk today, and we might move on into next week, talking about challenges to wills.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So will caveat, that's again a
will
legal
caveat.
Term people need to understand. That's probably not something they use, a term they use every day.
Yeah, no question about that, Ben. I mean, it's just like Cecil indicated, sometimes after someone passes away, obviously we learn what the will states, because there's an obligation for that to be put on record and the process of probate to ensue.
Mm-hmm.
And we, at that point in time, many times learn, about the circumstances regarding the will. There might be problems with the will on its face, such as, questions with regard to the signature. I mean, it could look terrible with regard to the signature.
Right.
We could, look at the date of the document and, think back about the condition of the person at the time that it was signed, and maybe we knew that the person has had dementia, Alzheimer's, significant type of cognitive impairment for years, and maybe it was only signed 3 weeks before he died or
right.
she died or
yeah.
something like that, or maybe we...
And
it's
the beneficiaries changed.
Or maybe we just have a very unusual situation, like, a very loving family and, the wife and two kids and... Everything goes to the caregiver, mm-hmm. In the will,
right.
Just strange things like that. So, in every state, there's a statutory procedure where you have the right to, as if you have standing, meaning if you would take otherwise through intestacy or if you were in a previous will, that type thing,
mm-hmm.
you would have the right to bring a caveat to the will. And that basically is a challenge to the will. It's a little bit different than your normal plaintiff versus defendant type lawsuit. A plaintiff versus defendant lawsuit is mm-hmm. a situation where, let's say that you're in a traffic accident and there's damage to your car, or you have medical expenses with the help and you can't get that resolved. Then there's a lawsuit that you would file against the defendant.
You're looking for a finding of fault.
Exactly.
There.
Finding a fault and damages.
Mm-hmm.
In a will caveat, it's what we call an in rem proceeding. So you file the action, and when you file it as petitioner, you're basically asking for the will, you're challenging the validity of the will. And at that point in time, you then notice up everyone who would have any potential claim in the estate.
Mm-hmm.
There's then an alignment hearing before a superior court judge, so the parties can align. Or not align at all.
And right.
So basically what that means is that anyone who wants to align with the side of challenging the will lets the court know that at that alignment hearing.
So they become officially a party to
That's
that.
Right. Officially a party. That's the That's word, a party. Right. And anyone who chooses to support the will, who would be referred to as a propounder.
Mm-hmm.
We got the caveator on mm-hmm. one side. That's the alignment on the challenging side, and then we have the propounder or propounders on the other side. That's alignment on the side where we're saying, no, this is the valid will and we're supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes, people who have an interest in the will and have standing don't align at all.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of stand by the sidelines and say, look, you guys figure it out and I'll live with whatever happens.
Right.
And once you take that position, then you don't have any right to be involved in the litigation. You also don't have any risk either, though. You're not in a position where you're going to be dinged for attorney's fees in the event that there's no basis for the caveat or any of those type things.
Well, it's interesting part of the law here is about who has standing.
Right.
I mean, because it's pretty broad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is broad because, we can look back at previous wills. in the event that you were a beneficiary under a previous will, then you would have standing because mm-hmm. the way that works is, let's say that we have the will before the will that's being questioned.
Right.
Basically, the way that would normally work would be that the will that's being questioned, by its own language, revoked the previous will. So mm-hmm. in the event that the will that's being questioned is set aside, then that, under almost every circumstance, is going to revive the previous will.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's basically the way that works. So anyone who would take under that will, and it's even conceivable that anyone who would take through the intestacy laws,
right,
would have standing as well. And it could be,
there's an old English phrase. I think, you brought it up one time too. Was it called the natural objects
of your bounty?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you can even have a charity here. Mm-hmm. Again, as Wes is explaining, you would need to look at the prior testamentary plans, and suppose the plan at one point, you know, included a charity, and now of course it's been changed to, you know, a family member, or let's say that it included, you know, a neighbor, a friend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not unusual at all, Ben. We tend to think that wills always leave assets to the natural objects of our bounty.
Right.
But there are many, many wills done in our office where mm-hmm. the beneficiaries are friends. They are long-term relationships,
mm-hmm.
you know, neighbors, churches, charities, things that are special and dear to the heart and soul of the testator.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not necessarily the natural objects of his or her bounty.
Right.
Now, there may be an inclusion in a will that leaves some of the estate to the family, and then a strong portion of the estate again to this close friend, this charity, et cetera. So what we're saying here is that in this alignment hearing, really anyone who in the past or currently
mm-hmm.
has an interest in this estate is allowed to come forth and align themselves and become a party and become interested in the validity of this last will and testament.
I think, I guess, probably the public listening in is going to say, well, you know, the caretaker who has is all of a sudden receiving everything in the last 90 days, and that would be a natural one. But what about, say, maybe it was a family member who may have a letter from the testator saying that, you know, you're going to get this at some point in time. They might have a standing too, or some other.
If a letter is just a letter,
yep.
and it doesn't meet the formalities of a holographic will,
mm-hmm.
then
I would
argue, and I think I would be correct, that person would not have standing to bring mm-hmm. a caveat.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still kind of here at the beginning stages of filing the caveat. We're at a point of alignment.
Right.
And the other things that you prepare as the attorney when you're filing a caveat, you don't just file a caveat. You also file under the statute an order to freeze the assets of the estate. The clerk of court has the authority and the directive by our statutes in order to preserve what the estate assets are.
Mm-hmm.
To enter an order stopping the administration. Now, estate assets with regard to expenses like taxes and the light bill and things like that can be mm-hmm. paid, but you can't use estate money of the decedent, to cover the cost of the defense of a caveat. For example, the caregiver who gets everything under
right.
the will
right.
can't use the decedent's money to defend his or her position
yes.
on the will.
Okay.
I mean, or it could be a family member, it could be anybody. So, but, you know, in the event that once the caveat's filed, in my opinion, if you don't get an order, as the attorney doesn't get an order freezing the estate, then that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's the statute transferred. Yeah.
The statute allows it.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody is kind of on their own coin at this point in time
mm-hmm.
as far as dealing with the expense of, you know, the caveat itself. All aspects of it. So that's an important part of it as well. So we're at a point where, you know, where we file the caveat, we have an alignment hearing, the parties get aligned. And once the parties get aligned, that's when the kind of the lawsuit then takes a life of its own. And we start moving forward kind of in your typical procedure with regard to litigation. What do we do next? I bet you know, discovery.
Yeah.
You've been down this road.
Yeah.
Here on the radio program. So, you know, we're then serving discovery to get all the information with regard to bank records, with regard to especially medical records. We want to see how the person was at the time that the document was signed. We want information with regard to previous wills, previous powers of attorney. Was a power of attorney being used previously? That may indicate that the person didn't have capacity to handle their own affairs if they're having to have someone else handle their affairs. Just a whole host of things that we need to gather through discovery. And frankly, in our office, you know, we have what I would refer to basically is very well thought out and boxed. I'd call it boxed discovery request and a caveat, because really when you're talking about whether the person had capacity to sign the will, whether the person was under undue influence, the documents and things that you need to request pretty much the same with regard to every case when you're talking about a caveat. So, you know, over the years, we have certainly developed discovery requests that are very comprehensive but pointed. You know, they're not overly broad. They deal with the issues that we need to deal with, so we can be efficient to get the information as quickly as possible, so we can get a better picture as to what, you know, really transpired with the execution of this will.
Okay, we're following through the process of a caveat, a will caveat, and we'll get to that in just a moment. Your questions are always welcome. 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. Hey, welcome back here at Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, and we're talking about will caveat. And we want to step back for just a second and kind of help with the estate planning side of that too, right, Cecil?
Well, Ben, I do think that it's that we can take a moment and step kind of back in time a little bit. Wes and I every week see occurrences where we feel in the planning side of the file. When the documents are being prepared, that due to certain facts and circumstances, maybe the medical health of the client, potentially conflicts in the family, that there is a flag, wow, this could end up being a will caveat. This could potentially be a will that would be subject to question. And so what do we as a lawyer on the front end do in order to mitigate the opportunity that a will that we have executed, signed, that we have guided through finality in our office is not challenged. And so this is something that our listeners should be aware of in terms of the lawyering that goes on relative to their estate planning. It is important that details be attended to on the planning side. If there's any feeling in the family that a will might be subject to challenge, and what kind of things am I talking about? Meeting with the testator outside of the presence of any children or undue influence or caregiver or whatever the case might be. Getting a letter from a physician stating that they feel that the testator is still able to make significant decisions. Do we have children from the prior marriage that are stepchildren to one of the spouses to the point that we think that there would be a possibility that some of these children could come in and challenge a will that is for the benefit of a second spouse? Do we want to meet with the client on more than one occasion? This is a very common thing that we do in our office, where the client will come in. We have a little bit of an uneasy feeling about their understanding of the document. They generally understand, but maybe not to the degree that you know, someone just in their, you know, younger ages would. And we would like to meet with them again. And the file is documented that this lawyer that I met with the client on a certain day, maybe Wes met with the client 2 or 3 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the same things were discussed at both appointments, and now finally the document
they're just
is
being
executed.
They're being affirmed.
Absolutely.
All about.
Absolutely. These are facts.
Yeah.
And as we're going to move forward here today and again to next week about a will caveat, what Wes is going to be explaining is that these are the facts that turn those will caveat cases one way or the other. We've already referred to the medical records, but there are other records. Okay.
And I would imagine as you go into the planning process, Cecil, to you also, if there's already estrangement within the family, then that's going to raise some flags. Too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All
right. That's true.
Well, yeah. And normally it's if somebody's really old,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of the one, but just because they're really old doesn't mean that they have the capacity to enter a will.
Mm-hmm.
But the process that I always go through, you know, to deal with these issues is, you know, I don't ask leading questions. I don't say, aren't your children Mike, Judy, and Jill? I ask them, please name your children for me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if they can name their children or name their family, bing, number one, okay, you passed that test. Because
right.
you have to know the natural objects of your bounty. And I want to hear it back from the person. I want to hear those names. I want to make sure they know who everyone is. What assets do you have? And I want the person to tell me, you know, I have a house. I have a little bit of money at so-and-so bank. I have a CD over here. You don't have to know down to the penny, but you have to generally know what assets you have.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to know, I want you to explain to me what you understand your will, what is it going to do?
Mm-hmm.
What is it, first of all? How does it operate? And what are you wanting it to do? How are you wanting to leave? How are you wanting the assets to pass under the will? Who are you wanting your executor to be? And if those three categories are answered appropriately, then that is those are the three categories that have to be answered appropriately for the person to have the capacity to enter the will. And always, of course, if there's another family member with the person, I'll ask them, like Cecil indicated, to go sit out in the lobby so we just have that one-on-one conversation.
Right.
And I always ask those three questions or categories of questions in front of the notary, in front of the witnesses, so that the witnesses, who are normally, you know, paralegals at my office, hear the answers to those questions.
They're not parties to it. Right.
Right. They're hearing the questions. They're hearing the answers. And then I'll always ask those witnesses, do you have any concern about whether Mr. So-and-so knows who his family is, understands his will and understands what he has? Do you think any further questions need to be asked? Those kind of things. Because, you know, we want to set that stage so that in the event there is a caveat, that they can, those witnesses remember that day.
Mm-hmm.
And those witnesses will say, well, Mr. Collins always goes through this process. And I've had that on multiple occasions, or Mr. Harvell, I've had that on multiple occasions where I've had to make the hard decision for the family.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, don't have the capacity.
Right.
And
right.
that's a difficult place for the attorney to be as well. You don't want to give that information to the family or to the testator.
However, you can then advise them that that's not the end of the road here. But you can now look at guardianship. You can look at other things.
You can look at that, and you can also, the law is replete with situations of lucid intervals.
Right.
Where the person, you know, anyone out there's listening who has, you know, an older family member, older person they've dealt with who has maybe dementia or Alzheimer's or just diminished mental capacity.
You know what a good morning
there
is.
There are good days. There are bad days.
A good morning.
You know, for most people.
Bad afternoon.
I mean, sometimes people are too far gone to be able to make decisions for themselves, you know, completely. But in my experience, there are certainly times that are the people are sharp and times where they're not as sharp. So, yeah.
Well, if more to come in a moment here, your questions welcome at 800-818-2255 or for Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. You can go online at harvellandcollins.com. Welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Talking about Will Caviat. We're just talking about lucidity, because I know I went through that with my mom with the dementia. Some days she was very lucid.
Right. And that's important because, you know, when we look at a will caveat, which mm-hmm. is our topic for the day, a challenge mm-hmm. of the will, the issue with regard to the capacity to enter a will is not the capacity around the time or the day before or the day after. Now, that's certainly relevant, but the issue is, did they have the capacity at the time they executed the will,
mm-hmm.
at the time? So, you know, the testimony of these witnesses watching the attorney ask these questions and making the determination as to whether the person actually has that capacity is, you know, that's very important, you know, to have that framework set up as opposed to, you know, printing right. the will off the internet and then signing it with a couple next door neighbors at the kitchen table. There's mm-hmm. a big difference there. If you want to increase the chance of a challenge, then having it signed at the kitchen table is certainly going to do that.
I would imagine a lot of times the challenges come when a family member knows that that person has been, let's just say, diagnosed with dementia.
They, right.
they may have the medical record that says that.
That's right.
But it doesn't speak to that particular notion of lucidity.
Just because that there's a diagnosis of dementia doesn't mean that you know, or the person doesn't have the capacity to enter a will.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that. I mean, there's certain multiple levels of dementia,
mm-hmm.
You know. So, but as I think most people know, that normally when someone does have a dementia or Alzheimer's diagnosis, that is not a situation that necessarily improves with time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, we have not a medical doctor here, but I mean the Namenda, the Aricept, the medications mm-hmm. here
right.
that are advertised to help maintain
mm-hmm.
or to slow the progression of the disease.
Right.
But we normally don't, you know, see a lot of improvement. We may see better days than others.
Mm-hmm.
But be that as it may, even if there's a diagnosis such as that, that doesn't mean that, you know, a will can't be executed as long as at the time of the execution, those three different categories are mm-hmm. answered appropriately.
I mean, you may have yeah. a time where someone doesn't appear to have the capacity, and then an hour later, they do.
Well, we were talking off the program. I know we just have a second here, but I had one client I'd known for 12 years, knew her well. She came in, did not recognize me. That was flag number one. I was concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
There were some other things she was doing where it looked like she just didn't have it. I had to tell the family at that point in time, you know, she just doesn't have the capacity today. I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to execute any documents. She got mad at me.
Mm-hmm.
The lady said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you've got to know, first of all, your family.
Right.
She said, boom, 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 this is my family.
Yeah.
I said, you have to know what you have. She said, I've got a house. I've got X amount of dollars at blank bank, yeah. X amount of this bank, blah, blah, blah. She answered every bit of it perfectly.
More next week.
Shocking.
See HarvellandCollins.com for past shows.